Hello and welcome, everyone. This is Mike Adams, the editor of naturalnews.com, joined today by Dr. Boris Worm, who is a professor of marine biology at the Dalhousie University in Halifax, Nova Scotia. He's the author of some very important, well-publicized papers talking about the delicacy of the web of life in the marine environment. And he joins us today to talk about that issue and maybe some things that we can do to help protect marine life. Thanks for joining us today, Dr. Boris Worm. It's great to have you on. Can you give our listeners a bit of a background of your work and your training?
Sure. So I'm a marine biologist. I studied marine biology and biological oceanography back in Germany, where I'm from originally. And about 10 years ago, I moved to Halifax, Nova Scotia, where I still work today. And, I started being interested in ecology, so how species in the ocean relate to the environment and to each other. And I, about 6-7 years into my studies, I started to understand that you cannot really do this anymore without factoring humans in and the effects we are having on the ecosystems and on species in the marine realm. So my work more and more became focusing on the impacts we're having on ocean species and their supporting ecosystems. And that's mostly what I'm doing today. So I'm dealing with a range of impacts. We're looking at fishing first and foremost, but also at the effects of changes in climate. I've done a lot of work on pollution as well, and to some extent how these different factors interrelate and interact.
What has your overall aha moment been in all of this? I mean, was there a moment where you said, wow, people are greatly underestimating the intricacies and the complexities of marine biology, or what was that like?
Well, there were several aha moments. One was, there was a paper which came out in 1997. It was called Human Domination of the Earth's Ecosystem. The first author was Vitusek from Stanford. And there they argued that now we're dominating a lot of the processes that shape ecosystems and life on Earth. For example, the fixation of nitrogen and the removal of biomass through forestry and agriculture and fishing and so on, and a variety of other processes. And these have been running for a long time naturally, but now our impact is dominating these processes. And then there were several others I recall when I was doing some experimental work in the Baltic Sea, and I was doing a lot of diving and snorkeling, and I was seeing lots of little critters. And at some point, I just started wondering, where are all the big fish? And why do I never, ever see anything that's larger than about a few inches, really? That was all that was there. And I started researching and getting more interested in the fate of large marine predators, which was one of the big bodies of work I did with Ransom Myers at Dalhousie University, where we asked the question, how much of those large predators has been left? And our research established that a large proportion of these creatures, these being things like tuna, billfish, sharks, but even large cod, halibut, species like that, have declined by up to 90% in many areas. And that really showed me how profound our impact had been, not just in some areas, but really all across the globe.
Wow. And yet during all of this, it seems that the people who are engaged in fishing have always said, oh, don't worry, there are plenty of fish in the ocean, right?
Well, it's interesting. This goes back almost 150 years now to some famous remarks by Thomas Huxley, who stated that, in effect, the great fisheries in the oceans are inexhaustible. We can make a dent into them, but we cannot really deplete them to any serious century. That notion was countered by a number of other authors who said, well, it's not even something that's a theoretical possibility. It's already happening. We're already depleting a lot of those fisheries, particularly ground fisheries, species like haddock and cod and so on. Even at that time, people were aware of it, fishermen as well as scientists. So I think there have always been a more optimistic and a more pessimistic view. And I think what we're trying to do today is try to reconcile these different views and find out where things really are. And I think there's a broad consensus now that fisheries worldwide are in trouble, and there's a lot of stresses on marine ecosystems. But there's also some success stories where people have managed to reduce our impact, and those efforts have been paying off greatly. And so I think it's important to still see both sides of the coin. It's not all hopeless. The situation is dire, but also we have some ways of fixing it, which is important.
Isn't it your research, by the way, that has been widely quoted as predicting a collapse of fishing stocks in 50 years if we don't make these changes?
That's correct. Yeah. So that is one of the one of our papers in 2006 in Science. We looked at the loss of species from ocean ecosystems and the rate at which that was occurring. And what we saw was that when you look at all the world's fisheries and the catches they provide, there was a trend that more and more of these fisheries were providing, were declining greatly in their catches, about 90% or more. And by 2003, when our data series ended, about 29% of fisheries, so almost a third, had gotten to a point where they had declined, or their catches had declined more than 90% below the historical maximum. And we interpreted this as a sign that those fisheries had in fact collapsed. And there was a great debate about whether that was the correct definition of collapse, but the reality was that those catches were declining, and the world catch, the cumulative world catch what we're able to get from the ocean, despite us trying harder and harder to fish it, we're catching less and less since about 10 years or so. So there's a broad consensus that ocean ecosystems have reached a limit where we're taking too much out, and at the same time we're putting too much of our wastes and garbage products in, and that's not helping either. So there has to be a new balance where we're only taking out as much as can, as grows back sustainably year after year, and we're only putting as much in terms of waste products as can be absorbed by those ecosystems, and those really have to go together.
How much do you think is the collapse in, let's say, marine ecology globally is due to chemical pollution, or say ocean acidification due to CO2 emissions, versus just overfishing?
So just to be clear, so whereas the trend is not positive, we're seeing more and more fisheries being in trouble year after year, there's still a lot of life out there. So that's one of the
reassuring.
Get across. So, but why are we seeing problems, you're asking? Well, I think most people would agree that fishing is probably the largest single impact. It has been around for the longest time. In coastal areas, we see signs of overfishing hundreds of years back. And those are spreading out from coastal areas into continental shelf and open ocean areas, now even into the deep sea. So that's a major problem we have to get under control. Then there's climate change. You mentioned ocean acidification. We don't see massive impacts yet, with the exception of the bleaching of coral reefs due to temperature extremes in the tropics that haven't been seen before. But, of course, we know that those impacts are only going to accelerate and intensify no matter what we do. So that's something we're concerned about for the immediate future. But right now, I think most of the problems we're seeing are related to fisheries. If you look at the global ocean, and if you look at coastal areas, you see a lot of pollution impacts as well, particularly those of eutrophication, which is the runoff of nutrients through agriculture and sewage and so on, which has caused some coastal ecosystems to be greatly damaged and even collapsing in some cases.
Isn't there pressure on the fishing industries then? As the coastal, more of the coastal fisheries collapse or are stressed, isn't there a tendency for them to just move farther offshore and explore more pristine ocean waters and start plundering those? Is that something that's real?
Yeah, well, that's absolutely true. That's the historic trend. And the only modification to your statement I would make is that this has already happened. We have already extended fishing operations all around the globe, and there's no ocean that has never been fished, and our human impacts really stretch to every little corner, even places in the Antarctic or in very, very remote areas in the Eastern Pacific have been fished and have been impacted a great deal, particularly with the removal of large marine predators such as sharks, tunas, billfish, and so on. Just to give you an example, I'm particularly concerned right now about the fate of sharks, because sharks are among the most vulnerable to fishing. They're very slow growing. They mature at about the age of humans, in some cases quite a bit later than humans, meaning they have to grow up for a long time and survive in order to reproduce. And if they reproduce, they're only having a few pups. They're not producing millions of eggs like other fishes. They're only producing a few pups. Again, not unlike some mammals. And there haven't been very many traditional shark fisheries. In fact, a lot of indigenous societies have revered sharks and seen them as mystic animals and so on, and specifically not targeted them, which was a wise decision, because we know now that those creatures have a large impact on ecosystems, and they're important component of those ecosystems, and they're hard to replace once they're gone, and they're slow to grow back. Well, since we've lost some of that reverence, sharks have been exploited relentlessly, particularly in the last 10 years for their fins, which is a horrible practice called shark finning, where the fins are cut off and the shark is thrown back, often alive, and then to die slowly from drowning or starvation. And that practice has grown like a wildfire around the world, and there are a lot of efforts to stop it, because people are seeing that the depletion of shark populations is much faster than for almost anything else in the oceans now, and the implications are quite staggering. So that's something I'm really concerned about, and that needs to be stopped on a global scale, really.
Yeah, sharks have been vilified through popular culture for so long that I think people are slow to accept the idea that this predator is very, very important to the long-term survivability of the ecosystem.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I see a recent culture shift where sharks are increasingly seen as the victims they are, not as the perpetrator of crimes. Somebody has calculated for every human that's injured by a shark, tens of millions of sharks annually are killed in return. So the balance is really going the other way.
Is there any website or nonprofit group that you can share that focuses on protecting sharks?
There's a number of them. For example, in Europe, there's the so-called Shark Alliance that you can just Google Shark Alliance on the web, and they've done tremendous work in protecting sharks. In France, there's a small NGO, Longitude 181, .com or .org, I guess, that has managed to protect sharks in French Polynesia, which is a very large portion of the Eastern Pacific, where sharks are still plentiful and where shark fisheries just recently tried to move in, and they've managed to stop that. Then Oceana, or the Ocean Conservancy here in North America, is doing a lot for shark conservation, and Greenpeace has also some effort. So a lot of NGOs are keying into the fact that sharks may be one of the most pressing, most rapidly declining conservation concerns in the oceans right now.
Now, what about the Antarctic you mentioned earlier? I wanted to ask you, I had a question about some of the harvesting going on there, because there has been some debate about that. What species, if any, are threatened by fishing there? Or does fishing there, is the biggest threat there the threat to the food supply of the mammals there? Or is it more of an environmental concern?
Well, first and foremost, of course, the Antarctic ecosystem has been changed greatly by the removal of large whales. So hundreds of thousands of whales have been taken from that ecosystem, and several species, including the blue whale, are very, very slow to come back. Apart from that, what goes on today is there's longline fishing going on for a species that's called Patagonian toothfish. It's marketed in North America as the Chilean sea bass. And that species is also, like most species that far south in Antarctic or in Arctic waters, those species are very slow growing as well, and slow to replenish. So There's a large illegal fishery going on for them, and for that reason, there have been efforts to make consumers aware that this is not a sustainably caught product, and they should refrain from eating it. And there are these consumer choice cards now, for example, at the Monterey Bay Aquarium. If you Google seafood guides, you will get a number of products that tell you which fishes, such as this Chilean sea bass or Patagonian toothfish, are unsustainable, and which one are good choices. They're well managed, they're plentiful, like Alaskan salmon, for example, and can be eaten, so to speak, with a good conscience. And I use those seafood cards all the time, and I find it a really wonderful tool to educate myself and educate others when you're in a restaurant or when you're ordering seafood in at the counter.
So it's called Chilean sea bass, but it's not from anywhere near Chile. It's as most people would think.
It does occur. It does occur south of Chile in the Antarctic waters. So yeah, but it's a pure marketing name. It's the same with orange roughy, which scientifically is often it was previously called slime head, and that didn't go over so well with the marketing folks. So they called it orange roughy, and it's another species that a lot of people are concerned about because, again, it's slow growing, late maturing. It's older than your grandmother. It grows up to 130 years, people believe, and it may only mature at age 30 or 40. So it's very, very slow to replenish, lives in the deep sea, and it's only recently been fished, again, marketed very successfully in North America as orange roughy, and probably a species you should not eat because it's not a sustainable fishery and it's damaging to the ecosystem.
Wow. So that's just like canola oil used to be called rapeseed oil.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it's, these marketing names are really interesting, and it can be confusing for the consumer. For example, snapper can be a large variety of things, not just the red snap from the Gulf of Mexico, but there's various species of rockfishes that are called snappers, and it's very confusing at times. So it's a good idea to carry these seafood cards around and be really discerning as a consumer and ask in the restaurant, what is this really? Is this Atlantic salmon or is it Alaskan salmon? Big difference there. Is it farmed? Is it wild? And to really demand to know these things. And I know in the European Union, for example, now every fish has to be labeled by its proper name, its scientific name, and also it has to say where it comes from, which ocean area, and also whether it's farmed or wild. And I think that's a good idea. We would never buy generic meat and not know whether it's cow or pig or whatever it is, and not no idea whether it comes from China or whether it comes from the U.S. We would demand knowing.
But in the United States, that distinction is often not made. I mean, there are no such labeling requirements.
Not yet. So I think it's up to consumers to demand these things. Yeah, and I know that that various organizations are pressing for such labeling because it's the first prerequisite for making informed choices. But there's other efforts as well. For example, there's a Marine Stewardship Council that certifies certain fisheries as sustainable. So they basically do the work for you, and they put a stamp of approval on it. And it's a good organization. World Wildlife Fund is co-funding it, and they're going through a lot of detail trying to certify fisheries as sustainable, making sure that they're not exhausting their supply and not damaging the ecosystem and so on.
And what's the name of that group again?
Marine Stewardship Council, msc.org. Yeah. And so if you see a fish, for example, Alaskan sailfish or Alaskan salmon certified by MSC, you know it's a good choice.
Let me ask you a question a little lower down the food chain here, because this has been a debate that I've been involved with, and I'd like your opinion on it. What about the krill harvesting out of the Antarctic, which is harvested both for nutritional supplements and sometimes for animal feed products or even agricultural product? Taking it out of specific feeding areas might put pressure on certain mammals. What's your take on all that?
Oh, there's no doubt that taking some of those foundation species that basically form the base of the food chain can be very risky. And I know there was a big interest in fishing krill in the 1970s from the Antarctic, I think particularly from the Russians. And there has been a lot of concern about it for that very reason, and that fishery never quite developed at the scale it was envisioned. And I know there's renewed interest in this and efforts to revive such critter fisheries, and I think it's not a good idea because, again, they form the basis for so many other animals. And recent research has shown beyond that warming to climate change to at the same time fish them, which will drive them down even further and compromise the entire ecosystem. So I believe a lot of people are very wary about it, and I hope there's enough opposition to limit those fisheries.
Wouldn't that also make it more difficult for whales to recover then? If their food source, such as krill, is struggling, then that makes it more difficult for larger mammals to repopulate. Is that a reasonable?
Yeah, definitely. But for example, penguins, there's good evidence that the recent declines in the number of penguins, various species around Antarctica, is linked to the diminishing supply of krill. So far, mostly from the warming trend, but if fishery comes on top of that, that could accelerate those declines. So again, I don't think it's a good idea.
Let me change the subject and ask you about the. I don't know if this is a myth or not. This is why I want to ask you this, but about this huge floating trash pile in the Pacific, and all of these little pieces of plastic that pollute the Pacific Ocean. I'm sure you've looked at this too. What's your take on it? First of all, is it true that there's a huge collection of floating garbage? And if so, how might that threaten the marine ecosystem there?
So it's absolutely true. Yeah, there's no doubt that there's millions and millions of tons of trash in the oceans, and it's accumulating in some of these ocean gyres, which are basically these big whirlpools where the water is trapped and it's circulating in a huge current. Round and round, and it traps this debris, and so it accumulates there. It's everywhere, but there it becomes very visible because it can't escape that particular gyre very easily unless it breaks up or it sinks down to the bottom. There's no doubt that the amount of trash in the ocean is a major contributor to mortality in mammals, for example, in fishes and seabirds. Albatrosses, for example, are often found dead with their stomachs just filled with things like lighters or toothbrushes or plastic capsules that contain liquid that glows in the dark in order to make to attract fish to fishing hooks in the dark and so on. So there's a huge amount of that plastic trash, and even if it breaks up, research has shown that it breaks up into tiny pieces that then float around and get taken up by filtering organisms that mistake it for plankton that they try to feed on. What the full effects are of this plastic on the ecosystem, few people have looked at that, but there's no doubt that it contributes to mortality of hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of animals every year. And again, a lot of people are concerned about this. There's efforts to do beach cleanups every year and to limit the amount of garbage that's put in the ocean, for example, from ships and so on. Again, everybody here, like with the consumer choices, everybody can help to limit the amount of trash that is put into ecosystems, avoid trash, and avoid dumping it near the sea and so on. So, and we can all make our voices heard that we don't think that this is a good idea that should continue.
Do cruise ships still contribute to that? I mean, I know there are regulations that they're supposed to follow, and probably all the U.S. cruise lines follow that. But I'm wondering, maybe there are some other international, or I don't know, maybe some Asian cruise lines or something that don't. That are there cruise ships dumping trash into the ocean?
Well, I believe international shipping regulations allow any vessel to dump kitchen garbage, which is probably okay. And this would include food waste. It's not allowed to dump plastics. It is allowed to dump metals, as far as I know, so empty cans and so on. So when people now, when they go to the deep sea and places that nobody has ever filmed or photographed, a lot of the things they observe there is not the animals that live there, but empty Coca-Cola and beer cans, which is a legal practice. And of course, they rot very, very slowly there. The water is only 2 degrees Celsius around the freezing point, and it's dark all year, and it's a very slow-moving ancient environment, and it's kind of disconcerting to know that it's being littered without trash.
Yeah.
So,
Where are all the plastics coming from? Just from coastal pollution?
well, yeah, until I think even 10 years ago or so, it was legal to dump for ships to dump their garbage overboard, all of it, including plastic.
Oh
I
my.
don't know when that changed, and I've heard that, for example, in military ships, it's still a common practice because they are often exempt from these rules or don't care. Then certainly a lot of fishing vessels don't. There's very little enforcement on these rules. Nobody checks when you come into a harbor whether you have enough of your garbage on board, or whether you have any garbage on board, or whether in fact it has mysteriously disappeared on your ocean voyage.
No, so anybody can just dump anything, basically. Let me ask you about aquaculture, farming versus just fishing. I've interviewed a lot of companies in Hawaii, for example, on the coast of Hawaii, who are running aquaculture farms. What's your take on aquaculture versus wildcrafting of fish?
Well, first and foremost, I think it's important to make clear that aquaculture cannot replace wild fisheries. First of all, a lot of aquaculture depends on fish products to feed farm fish.
Ah.
And even where they don't, some aquaculture, shrimp aquaculture, for example, bluefin tuna aquaculture, or sea ranching in the Mediterranean, very heavily so. And the conversion ratio is not very good. It depends on the species, but for salmon, I think they got it down to 2 to 3 to 1. So that means for 1 pound of salmon you're getting out, you're putting in 2 to 3 pounds of ground up herring or mackerel.
Ah.
So in a sense, to me, it's a little bit of a waste of wild fish because you could eat those herring and mackerel, but maybe they're not as fetching as high a price. So there's an economic incentive to turn them into salmon, even if it's at a loss of protein. For tuna, it's a lot worse. The conversion ratio of small fish that are fed to tuna, say in the Mediterranean, to fatten them up and then make them more valuable when they get sold, is about 10 to 1. So for 10 pounds of fish put in, 1 pound of tuna is being produced. So that's not a solution, and not more environmentally friendly than eating the fish in the first place. But then there's forms of aquaculture that are land-based and that are fed a vegetable diet, carp, for example, tilapia, and that where no or little fish meal goes in. So that's probably a better choice. And those seafood choice cards I mentioned, they often distinguish between those two forms of agriculture, and they support environmentally friendly forms, for example, tilapia, and they do not support, for example, salmon and shrimp agriculture.
So tilapia aquaculture can be run on a plant-based diet primarily.
Yes. Yeah.
What about, I know a company that grows mussels, and they don't feed them any fish. They just feed them, or they let them feed phytoplankton.
Yes, they feed by themselves, and mussels are usually seen as a sustainable choice, as something that's not taking from the marine ecosystems, but it's replacing the wild harvest of mussels or shellfish, which can be very destructive. For example, scallop dredging is one of the most destructive forms of harvesting because it just dredges up the seafloor and takes everything in its wake, whereas the aquaculture of scallops or the aquaculture of other shellfish, mussels or other bivalves, is a good alternative to that.
So that's a good rule of thumb that you just mentioned here, that when aquaculture involves feeding fish other fish, then it's very wasteful. It has a lot of overhead, but
Well, some people say it's the equivalent of shooting rabbits and squirrels and deers and then feeding them to lions in pens and then eating the lions. So to basically have carnivorous fish that eat other fish in aquaculture, and then feed them fish that you have to catch in the wild in the first place, doesn't seem a particularly good idea. And there's a health problem to this too, because you are with the fish you're extracting from the wild, they're carrying pollutants and heavy metals and organochlorines and so on. And as you're feeding them to other fish, you're moving up the food chain. And you're basically concentrating those pollutants in the final product. So there have been quite a few concerns about high-level pollutants in farm fish, particularly farmed salmon and also shrimp.
Right. Yeah, we've seen a lot of those reports in salmon, especially. Now, you hinted earlier that one of the best things that a consumer can do is to just make an informed choice when they're buying fish or ordering fish. Can you add anything to that on the action list here? Like, what can people do right now to make a difference?
Well, definitely your seafood choice is number one. Then when you're on the ocean or near the ocean, to not pollute, to tread lightly, to not take anything. If you like to fish recreational, consider doing catch and release rather than taking things. Only try to fish species that are not endangered. Try to eat species that are not endangered. Speak out against unsustainable practices such as the shark finning I mentioned earlier. And people's voices are heard. For example, the success story I described in French Polynesia, where shark fishing has been banned, was due to a petition that was signed, I think, by about 40,000 people that said, we don't want this to happen, and then the government decided to ban it. It was as simple as that. So I think people's voice can really carry a long way, and if you feel passionate about something, and you think something should not go on, or maybe if you feel something is done right for once, you should let decision makers know, and I think that will have an effect.
That's great information. I'm glad you mentioned that. And are there any websites that you'd like to mention too? That I mean, you already mentioned a few about the sharks, but are there others that you think are good sites to support?
Let's see. One I really like, if you're interested in ocean conservation and maybe you're thinking about publishing something on this topic also, a good photo site is marinephotobank.org, and it's for free, and you have to sign on, but you don't have to pay anything. And you can download pictures, for example, on shark finning. You can download a beautiful imagery on ocean life, but also how it's harmed by various practices. And you can inform yourself. The photographers there, they give you information on where exactly this picture was taken, what was happening, and behind the scenes, and so on. So I think that's a really good educational source. I really like the Monterey Bay Aquarium website. I think if you type in seafoodchoice.org, you'll land there. And they have done a great effort to not just put out these seafood choice cards that you can carry around in your wallet, but also you learn a lot by clicking on particular species that you like to eat. Maybe you like to eat swordfish, so you click on swordfish, and you learn where it's fished, how it's fished, what the problem is. But you will learn that particular fisheries, Hawaiian swordfish, I believe, are doing better than others, Atlantic swordfish, for example. And so you can make choices there again, and you just get more knowledgeable, and you know more what's going on. And then finally, the NGO community, some have just excellent websites. Oceana, for example, at oceana.org. You can just learn so much and educate yourself and become involved too. And they have a lot of petitions running where they lobby politicians to change destructive practices and to do a better job in ocean management. And you can suggest things yourself or sign on to those petitions if you feel so inclined. And I think all of these things are making a real difference. And the web is really enabling us to learn about these things. There's nothing stopping us from becoming involved. It's very easy for us to, with a mouse click, to sign on to a petition and potentially make a difference.
That's all great information, and I really have enjoyed this interview because you have a very thoughtful approach to things. I have one or maybe two more questions. They are, number one, you must have received a lot of criticism about the research you mentioned that was published in 2006. So my first question, how do you deal with that, or how do you find confidence in your own conclusions amid all that criticism?
Well, what we did was we replied to a lot of those criticisms in Science, the magazine where those findings were published. And we just took every single criticism. When somebody just said, this is bad science, and just ignore it because that's not a very specific statement. So if somebody said, I think that measurement is wrong because of this, and I think we should use this measurement instead, what we did in our replies, we just used the other measurement and saw whether that makes a difference. And it turns out it doesn't make a difference. So however you look at it, you're getting a very similar picture of the state of the oceans, and there's really no wiggling around that things are in trouble, and it's not getting better on a global scale. It is getting better in some regions, and that was a point I took from the criticisms that I thought was important, that we cannot only look at the failures, of which there are many. We also need to look at the success stories and where people have been able to implement sound management practices and make a real difference. And that has happened in some areas, and we can learn from that and implement it more widely. But I tell you, one interesting thing that came out of all these criticisms is that these people that criticized us very heavily, both in the literature and in the media, his name is Ray Hilborn. He and I teamed up in the end. We got to know each other, and we discovered that if we actually started to talk to each other, we're not that far apart in what we think is going on. And we compiled a working group of ecologists, but also fisheries scientists and people on both sides of the debate. And we've been working over the last 2 years together to find out where things really are and to chart the common ground of what we can really say with confidence and what we can all sign on to. And it turns out it's not that far from what we wrote in 2006, but it also, again, it incorporates more of the information on recovery and rebuilding of fisheries, and it's more proactive, and it's not doom and gloom, and we can really make a difference. We know how to fix this, and we can't get paralyzed by the numbers. So I think that's an important add-on piece that will probably be published later this year, where we will try to get that message across.
Oh, that was my last question for you, was what can we expect to see from you in the near future? And you sort of hinted at it there. You care to share any more details on that?
Well, it's just a synthetic paper that will be published, where we will basically chart a way towards rebuilding fisheries and correcting some of the mistakes that were done in the past. So that's at this point all I can say about it. But then, other than that, I'm working quite a bit on sharks, and I'm, as I said, I'm really concerned about this, really interested in what has happened lately. We've recently put out some work on the ecosystem effects of large predators. So what actually happens when you remove those large fish, mammals, turtles, sharks, and so on from the ecosystem, how it changes, and I'm continually interested in that. And finally, I'm also working on the effects of climate change and trying to understand more how that will add on to the stresses on ecosystems, and how we can make those ecosystems and fisheries in particular more robust so they can absorb and adapt to these stresses. Because, I mean, time and again, I find if we give marine life half a chance to recover, it will. And it is a fairly resilient system that has absorbed lots of shocks and disasters and stresses in the past. So I'm quite hopeful that if we do the right thing, we can see it through, and we'll continue to enjoy it for its beauty and all the benefits it provides.
You know, there's a growing group of people in America, especially, who deny that there is any climate change taking place or deny global warming. Just wondering if you have any comments on that.
Well, the comments I have is that the new administration has just injected a huge amount of funding into climate research and biological research, and particularly in the National Ocean Atmospheric Administration, which studies both the effects of fishing and of climate. So whatever mistake there has been in the past, I think gets corrected now. So I think we should look forward and take confidence in that as the new president has said science gets restored to its rightful place. Because I think, I mean, beyond the rhetoric, I really think that scientists have an incredibly important role in a very complex and rapidly changing world to just tell us what the consequences of our action and inactions are and the choices we face, and that there's no inevitability. There's choices we make, and we better make them consciously and with all the scientific information attached to them that we can gather, and then make the best informed decision. And I believe when we actually have that information on the table, and when scientists are reaching out to make it known, then we often do reach the right decisions, and we can be smart about how we handle our impact. So again, I think science has a very important role to play there. But everyday people have too, because in the end, it's all those little individual choices and decisions that then make the greater whole. So I think everybody can definitely improve the situation, probably more so than we think.
Well, thank you for taking this mission on, taking on this task of educating people and getting to the real science of this. We need more people like you in our world putting this information out there. I want to thank you for taking this time to join us.
Thanks. It was a pleasure to talk to you, and good luck, and all the best to your readers and listeners.
All right, you too. Dr. Boris Worm, everybody, who we've been talking to here, the professor of marine biology at the Dalhousie University in Halifax, Nova Scotia. Thanks for joining us today. Hi, this is Mike Adams here again at the conclusion of this interview. I just wanted to add an important note. I don't know about you, but I was really inspired by this interview, this information. I found that I was learning a tremendous amount about the importance of the marine ecosystem for the future of sustainable life on our planet. And I've spent a lot of time talking about protecting trees and protecting soil and protecting animals and, of course, fellow human beings. But I haven't talked much in the past about the importance of protecting the marine ecosystems on our planet. I mean, sure, we've done articles about the dead zones in the oceans and the mercury contamination of fish and so on, but this interview with Dr. Boris Worm really got me thinking that I need to focus more energy, more resources, more time on looking at the ocean. The marine environment is crucial to the future of life on our planet, on the entire planet. You can't even have sustainable life on land if your oceans are dead. So you've got to support ocean life if you want to have sustainable human life on land as well. So I have an announcement to make on this. I've decided to donate $5,000 worth of advertising space on naturalnews.com to the marine conservancy groups that were mentioned here by Dr. Boris Worm. If any of the groups mentioned here, such as Oceana or Greenpeace or Shark Alliance or Monterey Bay Aquarium, any of the others that were mentioned here, if they want to apply to receive this free publicity, they can just contact us through our feedback form on naturalnews.com, and we will schedule that to run, and we'll be setting aside $5,000 worth of ad space for those groups, specifically for this purpose, to help publicize the important work of these groups to Natural News readers. I think it's something that the readers of Natural News will really enjoy. It's something that I know I fully endorse and support doing, and of course, it will help support these groups and all of the ocean life that they are working to protect. So thank you for listening. I hope you found this enjoyable. And join us again as we continue to cover this topic in articles and future interviews right here on naturalnews.com. This is Mike Adams, the Health Ranger. Thanks for listening.